I don't know if you've heard the story of the person who was struggling with their computer. It wasn't working. So they called the help desk. And I said, got a problem here. The computer's not working. What can I do? And the guy said, well, what's the problem? Is it the monitor? Is it the computer? Is the monitor working? No, the monitor's not working. What about the computer itself? Is the computer working? No, it's not. Are the computer and monitor connected? I think so. What about when you press the power button on the computer? Nothing happens. And so the tech guy said, well, check in the connection at the wall. Is the power actually on at the wall? And the guy said, look, I can't see at the moment because there's a blackout. So the tech guy said, listen, what I want you to do when the lights come back on is I want you to disconnect the computer and pack it up in the box that it came in, and I want you to send it back to the manufacturers because you're obviously too stupid to have a computer. I don't know if that story true. It's true. I read it on the internet. I'm not sure if you're a manual reader or not, if you're good with technical things. Maybe the world is divided into those who read manuals before they start. Maybe there's three groups. Those who read them halfway through when they read them in trouble, and those who never bother. We've got to assemble something, put something together. Who reads the manual first? All right. Who wings it and is pretty sure they can work it out themselves? Who reads the manual halfway through when they realise they're in trouble? A few of you. So you may have noticed that we've actually got some heaters out on the veranda that we've had for morning tea. It didn't help this morning with that wind blowing between those two buildings. But we put those together a few weeks ago, and Gavin Plumridge helped me do that. And he was very good. He got out the manual, he read all the instructions first and started to build it. But then he had to go and cook dinner for the young people. So I took over. And I'm not a manual reader. I always think I can work this out. And I did. I got it built. There was only three pieces left over, which was great. I'm not sure how you learn best. See, I think we learn best by doing. I think that's the way we learn best. And I certainly did, because I put the second one together and there was nothing left over. So I did a better job the second time. I'm not sure if you know this, but the word disciple disappears from the New Testament after Acts 21. That's kind of interesting to me. That's when someone brought that to my attention. I thought, that's fascinating. So the word disciple disappears from the New Testament after Acts 21. Now, why would this be so? Because we've just read from Matthew's Gospel, and we know at the end of Matthew's Gospel, those of you who've grown up in the church, that it finishes with the Great Commission, which is go and make disciples. So why would the word disappear? And it's kind of helpful to explore why it does. So Paul, the follower of Christ, never mentions the word disciple, nor did James, nor does Peter in his letter, nor does John in the letters, the pastoral letters. What happened was this first century Palestine concept of rabbi and disciple about master and follower was actually about teacher and learner. Rabbi means teacher. It means teacher, which gives us a clue to our job for those of us who follow the master. Our job is to learn. Our job is to learn from Jesus. So, of course, Paul, who was writing to the whole of the Mediterranean world, not just first century Palestine, recontextualised that, and he talks about teaching all the time, and he in fact teaches. He talks about imitation all the time. He says, imitate me as I imitate Christ. It's about learning. It's about being a follower of Jesus, about learning to be like him. Now, Matthew can actually help us understand even more what this actually means, to be a learner, to be a follower, to be a disciple of Jesus. So as we said, we know from the Great Commission that discipling mattered. So in Matthew 28, Jesus says, therefore going disciple. He says some other words as well, but he says, therefore going disciple. Now, who was he saying this to? Well, he said that to the 12, but the lesson was to all of us. So who were these followers of Jesus? Who was following him? So John read that second story about the start of Jesus' ministry, and I don't know if you noticed that it finished with, "and large crowds followed him." Okay? So lots of people followed Jesus. We know that there was the 12 who were specifically called. We know that there was the women who followed Jesus and supported his ministry. We know there was the 70 who were sent out on one occasion to actually minister. And we know there were the crowds. All sorts of people followed Jesus. One of the interesting things, though, about the specific list, particularly the one of the 12 disciples, and if you read this, it's in Matthew chapter 10, verse 2. They're all listed in pairs. So when Matthew gives the list of the disciples, they're listed in pairs. And we know that often they were sent out on ministry in pairs. We know, for instance, that there were two disciples who were sent out to get the donkey before Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. We know that the great mission sending out in 10, he sent them out two by two. So perhaps there's this idea in discipleship as being followers of Jesus that we don't do this alone, that we do this with someone else. We do this together. And we might learn something else about the way that Jesus taught. Now, I studied to be a teacher some time ago now, and all the theories may have changed, but when I was studying back in the 80s, they actually talked about three basic modes of learning. There are three ways that most of us prefer to learn. We can learn in other ways, but there's three ways that we prefer to learn. The first one is auditory learners. So those are people who are very good at taking in information just when someone speaks to them, and they understand it well, and that's their preferred way to learn. Tell me what I need to know is what people say. There's some people, like me, who are visual learners, so would much prefer to see a scheme or a map or a mind map or a flow chart or some sort of memory device to actually help us learn, that makes us helps us to learn things in our head, to put things together. And the other basic way of learning is what they call kinesthetic. It's learning by doing, like physically doing something to help you remember what it is that you're processing and how you need to understand it. Now, what we know about Jesus was that he taught with all of these methods. He taught, he gave people words, but he also demonstrated, he also acted. He took other people with him on mission. He allowed them to think through what they were doing. Now, when Mum remarried when I was a kid, we moved to a place called Inverell in New South Wales, and we lived in a very old farmhouse. And when we first moved in there, we had a chip heater to make hot water for your bath. Now, some of you are younger than me, and you may not remember what a chip heater is, but let me explain. So in our bathroom, right next to the bath, there was a thing about this high, you know, kind of cylinder like this, and in the centre of it, you made a fire, and you poured in water in one side, and it made its way around the fire, got heated up, and then it came out the nozzle at the other end into your bath. Did anybody ever use a chip heater? So, you know, look at that. All right. So I'm very privileged. Not many people my age know what a chip heater is. One of the things that you had to do when you have a chip heater is you had to start your fire with wood. And so we had to go and cut wood. And so I was a city boy, right? I'd grown up in the city, so I'm kind of 7 going on 8 here. And so I went out to cut wood, and you had to cut kindling. And you had to use an axe to cut kindling. Well, I still have the scars on my fingers from where I learnt to cut kindling with an axe. That's called action learning, all right? Learning by doing. I learnt to be careful with the axe. After I broke a few axe handles when I was splitting the wood, I learned in another way to be careful with the axe when Dad pointed out what I'd done wrong and encouraged me to be more careful. Adventure learning, learning by doing. Learning on the journey, learning as we go. Now, of course, the disciples still asked Jesus questions. We know that. It specifically says the disciples came to him and asked. We know that from Scripture. But they were following Jesus, learning in all sorts of ways, learning by doing, learning with him, learning together. And Jesus was always the master teacher. And the goal for the disciples was not to become masters themselves. It was about continual learning, this continual journey of learning to be a follower of Jesus. One of the other interesting things is, of course, that normally in first century Palestine, rabbis didn't call their students. In fact, a student would seek out a teacher and ask the teacher if he was willing to be the teacher. But Jesus did call people, and he called these first disciples, and we read of that in Matthew's Gospel this morning. And Jesus is still our Lord who calls us to follow him. That hasn't changed. His call goes out to us, to the 12, to the 70, to the world. Our following him is a response to God's gracious call. But it's a call, not a command. The disciples were free to come and go as they chose, and some did choose to go. I don't know if you know that very poignant story from John 6. Do you know the story where Jesus had been delivering some hard teaching and people were grumbling? They said, "This is too hard for us. We're leaving." And they left. Many people left, in fact. And Jesus turned to the 12 and he said to them, "Do you want to go too?" And Peter responded and he said, "Lord, to whom else shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." You see, Peter had learned something on the journey with Jesus, and they followed still. Now, not perfectly, it must be said. Jesus knew that Judas would betray him. He knew that Peter would deny him. He knew the rest of the 12 would desert him, but he loved them and discipled them anyway. How? How did he do this? The interesting thing is that Jesus hardly ever did one-on-one discipling. It was really either the 12 or a small group, either two or three, as in the Transfiguration. You know that story where Jesus took Peter, James and John and they went up the mountainside and he allowed them to experience something and reflect on something that they saw, this revelation of God. Now Jesus' teaching also included right belief. This is what the kingdom is like, he would say over and over again. But he also taught them the right way to live, and he taught them the right way to die. Some of you may have attended Sylvia Collinson's sessions at our first Axios. I don't know if you remember the one we had at King's School. Sylvia Collinson came along, and she'd done a dissertation on discipleship in the Synoptic Gospels. And she talked about the fact that we always see the disciples in distinct groups. And she's actually plotted this out in the Synoptic Gospels. As we said, they were listed in pairs in Matthew and sometimes in groups of three or four, but there's this idea that they're always in these small groups together. And that might be a clue for us about what discipleship is actually about, this learning process, is that we don't do it alone. We learn with other people. We walk the journey with someone with us, someone at our side, someone to help us learn, someone to help us understand. It's kind of this reciprocal idea. You see, discipling is intentional, informal learning. And it is often relational and mutual. And its aim is to help each other to actively follow Jesus. In practical terms, it was a voluntary commitment to learn together and to minister together for the disciples as they followed their master. You see, what's the most important thing that you and I can do as Christians? The most important thing. See, I didn't know that James was going to tell that story of how he came to faith, how he came to be a junior soldier. What's the most important thing you can do in your life? I was talking to my mum, my auntie, her younger sister was dying of cancer. And mum was kind of sad and reflective and worried about her sister all at the same time. And she said to me, "When I look back on my life, I just don't know if I've helped enough people to follow Jesus." And my auntie was not a practicing Christian and So Mum felt convicted that she had to speak to her sister one more time about Jesus. She said, I don't know if I've done enough in my life to help people follow Jesus. You see, what's the most important thing you'll ever do as a follower of Jesus? What's the most important thing you'll ever do? See, we do lots of stuff in church, right? Heaps of stuff. We organise, we minister, we serve, we do all sorts of things, and we play and we sing and we clap our hands. But what's the most important thing you'll ever do? I think it's to help people follow Jesus. And that means our family too, of course. Now, it's great that Lorraine Kelly has taught our junior soldiers, but we wouldn't expect that she'd be the only teacher they ever have. Our junior soldiers need their peers and mentors to actually help them learn what it is to be a follower of Jesus as they learn to follow together. We have responsibility for our children, for our grandchildren, for our nephews and nieces, for those people we know. We have responsibility for our friends, for those who are wavering in their faith. We need to talk to each other about this business of following Jesus. We don't get together just to discuss weighty theological topics. We don't get together to discuss Calvinism versus Arminianism, as important as that might be. We don't just get together to discuss the army and its faults. And that might happen just on occasions. When we get together, we need to talk honestly and openly about our struggles and our victories, about our joys, about our fears, our hopes. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? How do we help each other do this? You see, discipling is intentional, informal, relational, and reciprocal. And because I'm a teacher, I thought you'd want a mnemonic aid to help you remember this today. So the letter at the start of each of those words is IIRR. IIRR. I'm calling it pirate discipling. Okay? It's intentional, it's informal, it's relational, and it's reciprocal. And so we gather together with fellow believers. We don't just talk about the football. We say, what's delighted you this week? What's brought you joy? What's on your heart? What have you been praying about? What have you been praying for? What's God been speaking to you about in his word? See, the disciples in Matthew had no idea where that follow me from Jesus would take them. They had no idea what it would lead. And ultimately, neither do we. To be a disciple is to be on a journey, to be a pilgrim. But it is a journey we take together with others. Now, this kind of intentional, informal discipling can be hard to start. How do we change those groups where we meet with our friends? How do we change the conversation to actually be about Jesus, about being his followers? I don't think it is easy, really. But it's our job. It might be the most important thing we ever do. As friends, as fellow pilgrims, we're to build each other up, to hold each other accountable in love. Jesus still calls us to follow him in pairs, in twos and threes, helping each other, learning in all sorts of ways as we journey with our master. And perhaps ultimately that's what being fishers of men means. It's not really about accosting strangers. It's not really about playing in the open air. It's not really about fishing in the hope that we get a bite. That's called angling, remember? But it's about casting our net, a net of intentional, informal, relational, and reciprocal discipling. Casting out our relational net. Who are the people that we know and love and care about and that we know can walk with us on this journey as we follow Christ? The Great Commission in Matthew 28:19 says, therefore, going disciple. It's our job. Jesus' earthly ministry started with a call to discipleship and finished with a command to go and make more disciples. I think it's our core business. I was going to do another memory aid there, something about crows, but I'll leave it for now. The two spellings of that word, it's our core business. Making disciples. Jesus said, come follow me. And we must do so as part of a caring discipling community. Why do we follow? Jesus says, walk like me, talk like me, act like me, learn from me. Jesus says, follow me, and let's learn together what that means. I'd love us to sing a song of commitment. It's about offering ourselves to Jesus. But we actually say, Lord, I give you my heart. I live for you alone. I don't know what's on your heart today. I don't know who's on your heart today. Are you thinking of someone that needs your help on this journey of faith? Are you thinking you need to ask someone to help you on your journey of faith, this journey of discipleship together? Are you thinking about your children? Are you thinking about your grandchildren? Those people that you love and you desperately want them to know Jesus as Lord and to follow him. That starts, I think, with us taking our responsibility as Jesus followers. So let's commit ourselves as we sing this song as a prayer together. This is my desire to honour you.